The next COP14 will take place in your country, in Egypt, under the leadership of your government. You listen for Ambassador Barsena what has been the outcome of our 3 days meeting, how you think this discussion and the recommendation fits on the objective of your country for COP14. And you are Minister of Environment. Tell us how you work with your other colleagues from agriculture sector in mainstreaming biodiversity.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Dear colleagues at the podium, all protocol observed, thank you very much for having me. I'd like to thank FAO for their invitation. Thank you very much for the invitation and for your hospitality. I have listened with very carefully and with interest to the outcome of the of your deliberation throughout 3 days of work. I'd like first to congratulate you for a very successful meetings and deliberation, and I'd like to assure you that this is exactly what we are working on in Egypt and preparing for the COP. Let me first start by reminding you that in Cancun we did address and focused on mainstreaming of biodiversity issue in agriculture and in tourism. And in Egypt we will be addressing, let me say, more difficult sectors. We'll be addressing mining, we'll be addressing petroleum, we'll be addressing infrastructure, we'll be addressing health. We're going a little bit further into into sectors that are not really usually working on this. And that's a challenge for all of us, because we together, and I'm sure of that, we will find ways to address these issues. Let me just start by highlighting two things. We've been addressing biodiversity issues for a long time now. And until now, with all my respect, we were not able to talk the language that the business sector understands. Our topic is very scientific. And by the way, I come from the academia, so I am a professor, so I do understand this. But we were not, and let's face it, we were not able to get our message through the system, through the decision-making process. So I think we need to change our language. I think we need to work on positive loops and then move to the negative one. The only way is that we achieve success in the first round of negotiation with the business sector. We have to speak their language based on our knowledge. We have to be able and capable of moving this into a message that could be understood by the public and could be understood by the business, and then we can work, as I said, on the positive loops. And I think this is possible, and I think maybe this is where we need to work a little bit and hammer out these measures. And then we'd like that your COP in Sharm el-Sheikh becomes different from other COPs, is that there is a little bit change of language and how we address. The other thing is then the delinking between the two conventions, the one on the climate change and the one on the biodiversity. We have to link them. If climate change is getting all the focus, well, join the winners. They are related. You can't talk about on climate change without talking about biodiversity. We will be having the climate change the next in Poland. Just a few weeks, a week later or whatever. We should link the two so that we can go and put this on the table in Poland, whether it is under adaptation or related to mitigation, but it's all the same. I haven't mentioned the third neglected convention the certification. We all know why it's neglected. You get the feeling that it's dying. I don't know if I'm the only one that have this feeling, but there is no interest. But the certification, if it's linked with adaptation and with biodiversity, then we get the three conventions together. And this is what it's all about in Rio in 1992. I'm old enough. I have seen in Rio, and I was there. So I'm old enough. I know what was discussed there. So these are the two issues that we have approved with the secretary that will be, if I may say, the Egyptian approach to COP14. And that's what we agreed on in Cancun when we were presenting our approach, if we were to get the honor of hosting the COP14. The preparation for COP14, well, it's going well. We even are building a new building in Sharm el Sheikh for you. So it's going to be a little bit costly, but it's worth it. So we'll be building another building. We are working hard. We're trying to get the blessing of Mr. Cooper. It's hard. It is tough. I know, I can tell you this. It is tough. It's taking half of my time anyway. But it's an honor. And we are privileged in Egypt to have you with us in Sharm el Sheikh. So we're doing our best organizationally. We have a big organizational committee that's working, I don't know, with 20 ministries. And there are ministers now that are involved. So we're going to do, rest assured that we're going to do our best that you will have all the facilities that you need so that we can all work hard. And I must remind you that in the governorate of South Sinai, this is where Sharm el Sheikh is, over 50% is protected areas. So you will have a unique chance to visit our protected areas and to see our biodiversity. If I may move as a Minister of Environment addressing biodiversity issue, well, we have moved, I think, as all countries. We have moved back in 15 years ago, 20 years ago. There was always this, you know, this mandate issue between the Ministry of Agriculture and the Ministry of Environment and biodiversity issue. It's always like that, I think, in all countries. But we can see that there is a change in trend. I think this is even on a global scale, that the two ministries are working better now together as we go and as we gain experience and as we know the relations more better. The two ministries have become, in our case, working together. We even drafted a law for biosafety together. And I have asked the Minister of Agriculture to present it to the cabinet and to the parliament, which happened. And it's now in the parliament and will be approved soon. There are two other legislation that we have are passing now at the moment in Egypt. One on the APS, that it's now in the parliament. And we have a third one on the new law on protected areas that enables that we get local communities on board in the economic use of protected areas. So for the first time in Egypt, there will be an economic organization for the protection and management of protected areas. Of course, within environmental regulations, of course. These are three major pillars in the new institution set up for biodiversity and protected areas. At the same time, Egypt has finished its 2030 sustainable development strategy, and we were able to mainstream all environmental issues, especially biodiversity issue and protected area issue, in the sectorial programs of energy, energy and electricity, transportation, industry, all of them. We have managed to put and to integrate the environmental dimension. I think this is maybe one thing that we did in Egypt, and we'd like to give our experience in it, because we were struggling with this concept since 20 years. I myself have developed, as a consultant, I have developed three environmental action plan, national action plan, that never saw the light because they were just not part of the national economic development. So what we did this time, when I became a minister, I agreed with the Minister of Planning that he takes over the preparation of the sustainable development strategy. Of course, he will need my assistant, so I'll be there and my team will be there. But he has the control over the investment. So every ministry that's coming will put the environmental dimension so that to get the investments approved and to get during the follow-up, it becomes a normal mechanism to report on the environmental issues. So one way of doing things, I think we were very successful. Now, the Minister of Planning is going everywhere now and speaking about environment. Well, that's good, because environment ministers, if they are successful enough to work through others, then they did their job. So that's what we some of what we are doing in Egypt. But again, it's all about policies. It's all about policies. How can you formulate your environmental problems and issues into policy that could be applicable? But if we speak only on the environment, it's not going to work. I'm an environmental economist by education. Okay, so, and I have learned this a long time ago. But it really, without policy, without good policy, without taking the advantage and integrating this into economic policy reform, how they relate to environment, what's their impact on the environment, it's not going to work. So thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to see you all in Sharm el-Sheikh. Thank you very much, and have a nice day. Thank you.
Thank you for reminding us the importance of policies, how we can better integrate policies, and how we need to change our language to speak in a language that the business community can understand and feel an interest in working on biodiversity. And we have business people in this room, and I am sure they listen to your call. And the another point you raise is the importance of linking the three conventions. But we'll talk on this later. We have the champion of COP24 here. The next speaker is His Excellency Vo Thuan Nam, Vice Minister for Natural Resources and Environment, Vietnam. Your Excellency, you have heard that mainstreaming biodiversity calls for working at all levels, global, regional, and national level. Can you please tell us how you see this integration working at all levels, and how are you mainstreaming biodiversity in your country, Vietnam? Thank you.
Where you're from, make the way.
Okay. Thank you.
Loa.
Excuse me. You have a problem.
Meet the wind. Meet the wind.
Good morning. On behalf of the Vice Minister of Nature and Justice and Environment, we would like to thank FAO. Good morning. On behalf of the Vice Minister of Nature and Justice and Environment, we would like to FAO invite to attend this meeting. We think that the meeting very important for us to prepare and discussion about the biodiversity measurement across agriculture sector to COP 14 next November in Egypt. Ms. Maria Helena Simbender, this distinguished guest, ladies and gentlemen, Vietnam has been acknowledged as one of the most prioritized for global conservation due to its resilience in biodiversity. Biodiversity plays a very important role in the socio-economic and environment development of Vietnam. It is also a vital role in the provision of biodiversity service. Through this service, biodiversity makes a significant contribution to the national economy, providing basic for ensuring food security, maintaining gene resources and livestock and plants. Vietnam is a member of different multilateral agreements, such as the UNFCCC, UNCCD, and became a signatory to the United Nations Convention on CBD in 1944. The government of Vietnam has taken a solid interest and made substantial investment of both human and financial resources to implement its commitment and obligation under the convention. Vietnam has developed a legislation framework to mainstream biodiversity into the development planning. The Prime Minister has approved the decision on the National Biodiversity Strategy to 2020, Vision to 2030. The legal document has clearly identified the main direction, program, and project for the biodiversity conservation and management. The decision has provided orientation for the for a conservation and management of biodiversity. The government of Vietnam has integrated elements of both environment protection and the biodiversity conversion into the national plan, program and policies, national sustainable development strategy. Many economic sectors such as agriculture, forests, fisheries have begun to integrate biodiversity conservation as one of their strategic development goals. Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, further efforts for biodiversity management need to be conducted by the government to harmonize between the development and conservation. Collaboration between the different line ministries is required, and further support to development partner would be critical for the management process. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for bringing us this interesting perspective from Vietnam. Et maintenant, le prochain panéliste est Son Excellence Abdelrahim Lafi, le Haut Commissaire pour les eaux et forêts et la lutte contre la désertification au Maroc. Excellence, le ministre de l'Égypte a parlé de l'intérêt de faire une connexion entre les trois conventions. La Convention sur la biodiversité, la Convention sur les changements climatiques et la Convention de lutte contre la désertification. Votre pays était le président de la COP22. Vous êtes aussi haut-commissaire pour la lutte contre la désertification. Comment vous voyez la connexion entre ces trois conventions au niveau global, régional et national? Et comment vous travaillez pour intégrer la biodiversité dans votre pays, le Maroc? Vous avez la parole. Merci.
Merci, Madame la Présidente. Excellences, Mesdames et Messieurs, je voudrais tout d'abord remercier la FAO et la Convention sur la diversité biologique d'avoir organisé cette rencontre et qui essaie de faire le lien entre la diversité biologique et les modèles de développement. Un développement durable s'entend. Je voudrais pour ma part essayer d'effectivement de me joindre à ce qui a été dit sur les liens entre les trois grandes conventions de Rio du sommet de la Terre de 1992 et d'essayer de passer d'une réflexion globale au national et au local, mais aussi entre l'universel et le thématique et le sectoriel. Parce qu'il me semble que la question qui nous préoccupe aujourd'hui, c'est de trouver des réponses à ce qui s'est passé sur ce long cheminement depuis le sommet de Stockholm de 1972 sur l'environnement et jusqu'à Rio 1992, et en passant évidemment par ce concept de développement durable qui a été élaboré et qui permet de faire le lien donc entre ces trois composantes, comment créer la croissance sans attenter à l'intégrité des écosystèmes naturels et en tenant compte évidemment de la troisième composante qui est essentielle et qui est l'aspect social. Il me semble que la question de l'approche est importante parce que nous avons vu qu'à travers les trois grandes conventions, la diversité biologique, les changements climatiques et la lutte contre la désertification, quels que soient les efforts qui ont été consentis par les uns et des autres, les différentes rencontres qui ont suivi Rio 1992 ont montré que les clignotants rouges ont continué donc à être là sur la plupart des thématiques. L'érosion biologique a continué, l'érosion de la diversité biologique, la dégradation des sols avec cette perte en productivité, mais également avec tous les liens avec la sécurité et la durabilité, et aussi avec les changements climatiques. En 2002, c'est-à-dire Rio plus 10, sur le sommet du développement durable, ce constat a été fait, et en passant évidemment par Nagoya en 2010, où il était entendu qu'il fallait peut-être changer d'approche. Et pour ma part, je vais partager un certain nombre de réflexions qui me paraissent importantes. D'abord, nous sommes devant un questionnement qui est un défi central. C'est celui de pouvoir gérer la complexité et de gérer la globalité. Parce que je pense que nous vivons dans un monde où on n'a jamais produit autant de savoir et de connaissances scientifiques, techniques, mais nous n'avons jamais connu autant de dégradation dans notre environnement d'une façon générale. Il est entendu que la dégradation a commencé depuis très longtemps, parce qu'il y a 100 000 ans, c'est-à-dire c'était hier, il y avait encore 6 espèces d'hominidés, il en existe une seule, Homo sapiens, c'est-à-dire nous, et qui continue donc à dégrader l'environnement d'une façon inquiétante. Et je pense que ce défi central vient du fait que nous avons essayé de découdre cette complexité en essayant de simplifier et en essayant d'avoir des visions linéaires sur chaque thématique et sur laquelle nous avons avancé beaucoup. Mais l'essentiel, c'est la globalité et la complexité qui répondent à d'autres critères, parce que nous sommes éminemment dans une vision spécifiquement chaotique dans le sens mathématique du terme, c'est-à-dire il y a probablement cette tentation de vouloir modéliser et qui permet peut-être d'évacuer quelque chose qui peut paraître comme accessoire, mais qui est essentiel dans le déterminisme de ces écosystèmes. Et c'est pour cela que je pense que l'un des défis majeurs, c'est d'essayer de coupler tout ce qui a été fait maintenant pour essayer d'avoir une approche et qui permet de gérer cette globalité. Nous avons parlé de la diversité biologique. Il est impossible de parler de la diversité biologique sans parler de changement climatique, comme il est impossible de parler de désertification sans parler de changement climatique. Donc les trois grandes conventions de Rio sont intimement liées et il était dès lors nécessaire de les voir, de les examiner et de les appliquer d'une façon concomitante, c'est-à-dire en même temps. Alors, je vais essayer donc de passer de ce global, donc du concept d'une façon globale, vers l'opérationnel, parce que il est parfois assez simple de conceptualiser, mais lorsqu'on passe à la gestion des espaces et lorsqu'on passe à l'opérationnel, il y a probablement un certain nombre de ruptures qu'il faudrait résoudre. Très tôt après 1992, nous avons au Maroc, à travers un colloque qui s'est tenu donc en 1996, produit les principaux schémas directeurs qui répondent à toutes les préoccupations qui ont été évoquées, notamment au sommet de la Terre de 1992. C'est à ce moment-là qu'il y a eu le plan national de reboisement qui prévoit donc de reconstituer, de restaurer les espaces forestiers, le plan directeur des bassins versants, parce que les bassins versants, c'est un questionnement important, puisque nous savons que, surtout dans le contexte des changements climatiques, les événements extrêmes feront que les pertes en sol, l'érosion donc à l'amont des barrages notamment, vont s'accentuer. Et à ce moment-là, évidemment, il y a de gros risques au niveau des infrastructures, notamment de retenue d'eau, les barrages, et pour lesquels l'envasement constitue donc un problème majeur. Il y a également tout ce qui concerne le schéma directeur des aires protégées, dans le cadre de ce qui a été dit et fait dans la Convention de la diversité biologique. Et il y a aussi un certain nombre d'autres plans, tels que le schéma directeur de lutte contre les incendies, qui est un problème majeur au niveau du bassin méditerranéen notamment. Nous savons qu'il y a plus de 50 000 incendies qui sont recensés dans le bassin méditerranéen par an, avec des pertes qui dépassent les 700 000 hectares. Donc ceci est important et ceci est appelé à devenir encore plus important avec les prévisions ou les pronostics au niveau des changements climatiques. Alors dès lors, nous avons vu qu'il fallait probablement changer d'approche et d'aller vers trois portes d'entrée qui nous paraissent essentielles pour passer donc aux déclinaisons opérationnelles de ces trois grandes conventions. La première entrée est une entrée fondamentale, c'est l'entrée territoriale. Nous considérons l'unité territoriale, le territoire comme unité de travail et dans lequel il fallait conduire un travail important qui permet de construire un certain nombre d'indicateurs, parce que lorsque nous parlons de développement durable, il faut produire un certain nombre d'indicateurs pour savoir si nous sommes sur la lancée, sur la tendance d'un développement durable ou non. Donc, par rapport à cette approche, nous avons pratiquement une cinquantaine d'écosystèmes naturels. Tous les écosystèmes sont différents les uns des autres. Il fallait produire des indicateurs propres à chaque écosystème qui permettent d'intervenir à trois niveaux. D'abord, de construire les politiques publiques. Deuxièmement, d'évaluer en cours d'exécution ces politiques publiques et qui permet d'avoir un feedback qui permet de corriger et d'ajuster, parce que comme on l'a dit, la dynamique des écosystèmes est extrêmement complexe et on a besoin d'ajustements permanents. Et en dernier lieu, des indicateurs qui permettent d'évaluer la pertinence, la réussite et le succès de ces programmes. Alors là, c'est un programme donc, qui a été mis, donc je passe sur les détails, mais il a intégré un certain nombre de composantes qui intègrent la sensibilité à la désertification, qui intègrent également la sensibilité des sols, qui intègrent un certain nombre de paramètres, tels que la charge pastorale, parce que nous savons que les parcours constituent un problème majeur au niveau de la dégradation des écosystèmes, non point uniquement parce qu'il y a une surexploitation des ressources foragères, mais surtout à travers le piétinement, le tassement des sols et qui favorise dans le contexte du changement climatique un ruissellement au détriment des infiltrations des eaux et par voie de conséquence un certain nombre de problèmes à l'aval des bassins versants d'une façon générale. Alors ceci donc à travers donc, des approches assez intéressantes, ça nous a permis de définir ce que nous appelons les zones homogènes, les écorégions, écozones ou écosystèmes, et qui obéissent à cette classification. En gros, il y a 8 écorégions qui ont été identifiées. La deuxième porte d'entrée, c'est la sensibilité à la désertification. Parce que nous savons qu'il y a eu la désertification d'abord sous forme structurelle, parce qu'il y a une aridité du sol qui est couplée, donc une surexploitation des sols qui donne ce phénomène d'irréversibilité qui est la désertification. Et nous savons qu'à l'échelle mondiale, c'est un élément important, puisque dans l'un des objectifs des ODD à l'horizon 2030, il est prévu ou il est attendu à ce qu'on puisse restaurer au moins 12 millions d'hectares par an pour arriver uniquement à la neutralité des sols. Donc cette neutralité des sols nous permet, effectivement de garder uniquement cette situation à l'état où elle est actuellement. Le troisième porte d'entrée qui est importante, et c'est extrêmement important, c'est celui de la gestion du risque, de l'adaptation. Et par rapport à cette entrée, il est évident qu'un certain nombre d'éléments sont importants pour essayer de disposer des outils qui permettent de lutter notamment contre les changements climatiques, parce que quelles que soient les mesures que nous pouvons produire actuellement, l'inertie du climat fera que cette dégradation continuera. Et s'il est prévu donc en 2050 d'arriver à la neutralité carbone, donc il faudrait travailler dès maintenant, et surtout lorsqu'il s'agit de gérer et de travailler sur le temps long, c'est-à-dire le temps écologique, qui est infiniment plus lent que le temps économique ou que le temps électoral, et que dans ces conditions, il convient d'intégrer tous ces éléments pour essayer d'aller vers une forme d'arbitrage qui permet de ne pas privilégier la pression du présent, l'urgence des besoins actuels, au détriment de la pérennité des écosystèmes d'une façon générale. Donc je voulais attirer l'attention sur cette nécessité de coupler d'abord les trois conventions, mais de travailler avec une entrée territoriale qui permet de travailler, de réfléchir globalement, parce que l'intégration dont on entend parler, il paraît que l'intégration est comprise surtout sous une forme d'addition ou d'association de plans sectoriels ou de thématiques. Or, l'intégration, c'est exactement l'inverse. C'est une réflexion globale sur une unité de territoire et qui permet de décliner ces opérations sous forme de plans opérationnels qui permettent justement de travailler dans un cadre intégré et pérenne avec les systèmes agricoles, les systèmes forestiers et toutes les ressources hydriques ou la diversité biologique d'une façon générale. Je vous remercie.
Merci, Excellence, et merci de nous avoir rappelé l'importance d'avoir une approche écosystémique, une approche territoriale, et aussi de l'importance des politiques publiques et des indicateurs pour mesurer les résultats. Now, allow me to address our final panelist for this first panel, Thomas Kruskov, COP24 Special Envoy for Climate Change and High-Level Climate Champion. We have been referring on the importance of the linkage of the convention, and that COP13 will take place 1 week before COP24, and we expect the results of COP14 will be included on COP24. Can you give us your view how it will be the linkage on the two conventions and how COP14 will lead to COP24? The floor is yours.
Yeah. Can you take a pic? Well, something for the Twitter. Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody, and thank you, Maria Helena. You are mastering pronouncing my name, so it's really encouraging. Maybe we can be as successful at the COP. Distinguished colleagues, I think it's a very important conclusion of the work yesterday and day before yesterday that In fact, everybody here is speaking about the need to bring the Rio conventions together, to see the synergy between the climate change convention, biodiversity, biological diversity convention, and also the convention to combat desertification. These three Rio conventions are all about the same. They are all about restoring the balance between various components of what we call climate system, what we call our environment. And the tool that climate change convention created back in 2015 in Paris Agreement, is probably the most global, the most comprehensive, and the most far-reaching environmental agreement so far. It is very clearly recognizing the importance of addressing the vulnerabilities of all countries, including vulnerabilities of food production systems. It is very clear about establishing a fundamental priority of safeguarding food security and ending hunger, and also recognizing the importance of conservation of biosystems, which will serve as the sinks and reservoirs for greenhouse gases. This is, of course, about forests. This is, of course, about soils. This is about all those components of surrounding world that are natural stocks for atmospheric carbon. Carbon that belongs to timber, to the woods, and to soil. Because carbon in soil means an improvement of soil's quality. It means an improvement of the biodiversity within the soil. It means more fertile fields and better crops, better yields. Paris Agreement has also made very clear that the ecosystem needs to be seen in an integrated manner. And it clearly mentions, referring to the Climate Change Convention, that there are all those components that we are now discussing, the oceans and entire hydrosphere, which is, by the way, polluted with plastics now, and we have to do something about it. The soil, the geosphere, that must be protected and must be prepared to raise to the challenge of having 10 billion people very soon. It's about food security for these 10 billion. The biosphere, and thanks to its diversity, it serves not only as the lungs of the planet, but it is also the habitat of the people and countless species, animals, plants, and of course the atmosphere. Well, let's better not imagine what would have happened if this atmosphere was not as good quality as it should be. We have examples from all over the world where the quality of air makes people die. It's not just better or a little bit worse quality of life. It's the issue of life and death. So we have all these four components, the biosphere, the atmosphere, hydrosphere, and geosphere, and the synergy of actions on all four is the precondition of the success of any implementation of any of the three Rio conventions and any of this convention's protocol. Many mentioned the role of private sector. Paris Agreement mentions non-party stakeholders. Private sector is, of course, included in this wider list. And the implementation of the agreement, the achievement of the goals, of the overall objective of the agreement without participation of non-party stakeholders would not be possible. And climate policy, and I believe it would be applicable to any policy related to environmental protection, could only be successful if it takes fully into account social and human, as well as economic dimension of any action. And what we have to do now, this is our biggest challenge, is the transition from where we are now to the future that Paris Agreement calls climate neutral. The future where the emissions that are unavoidable would be balanced by the capacity of global biosystem to absorb the atmospheric carbon. And this is the vision of climate neutral future, the vision of Paris Agreement that is within the reach. And it is within the reach by mid-century. I strongly believe that some technologies needed already exist, some other will be developed, but what we need now is an integrated action to restore biodiversity, to improve quality of soil, to make it as rich as possible and as fertile as possible, to stop desertification, which is being driven by climate change, but also drives the change on local level. So, in other words, we need everybody on board. The governments will give political signals and legal framework, but local communities, cities, businesses, everybody have to get ready for sustaining not only demographic pressures, but also more severe impacts of extreme weather. So we need also to adapt to climate change to be able to respond to the impacts and to reduce its consequences. Also to reduce climate-related risks for investors. So that these would be the elements that are driving the sustainable transition to climate neutrality that we all need. The transition that would also bring decent jobs, new investments. Distinguished colleagues, we have already mentioned that what we call climate action, these activities of everybody, not governments, but businesses, cities, academia. This is what does not need any formal approval. This is what some call Nike approach. Just do it. You see the problem, act on it. And I think that this approach could be successfully deployed in every convention. And I, after listening to my friend Minister Fahmy, I can only say that, well, I'm sure that the COP14 in Sharm el-Sheikh will praise this kind of approach. This action is needed everywhere, every day, on every level. Doesn't matter whether it is global or local, because the consequences are always affecting people on the ground and are not necessarily the consequences that could be solved on global level. And one more thing. It is about so-called traditional knowledge. There is a lot of traditional knowledge, traditional historical heritage of living in harmony with nature. This traditional knowledge of indigenous people, their indigenous technologies, their approach to using the resources that are local and available, and they know how to do it in a manner that is not excessively burdening the environment. This is something that we should recognize and offer the support of governments, the support of entire societies. This is kind of the future that we want, isn't it? Thank you.